I think Lance may get his get his wish fulfilled. He's out of town today, and he said, "Now, and he may be the only one that feels this way." By the way, he said, "Oh, David, I hate missing hearing you talk about the church's influence on music." But he said, "Hey, you probably won't get started till 9:15 or later anyway, and by the time you get through with some of the preemptory things," said, I bet I get to hear most of it next week, which incidentally won't be next week, because next week is Easter, and we're not going to, well, you folks could probably settle down for a class next week, but the ones that you bring with you probably won't. So we're going to need everyone here, especially those of us who have no children at home, we all need to rest up so that we can help the parents who have the sugar-crazed children next Sunday, and try to help them keep them reined in somewhat. But we're grateful for a gorgeous morning, and I was given / volunteered to try to take on the topic of the church's influence or Christianity's influence on music. Remembering that the series of classes that we're in right now, we rather boldly entitled The Christian Revolution. And the areas that we've looked at, economics, basically the polity of society, things of that nature, we are looking at, we are very clearly acknowledging that what we have looks in many ways the way it looks because of Christianity. And therefore, you know, when I took it, I said, okay, I've got Christianity's impact on music. And I determined that I wouldn't try to do something that says, well, you know, I'll make up all this stuff, or I'll try to twist the facts, because I think some people are guilty of twisting the facts to make something look more important or make something look more of the evidence flows a certain direction than it really does. And I don't want to do that. However, with that said, as we go through, I think you're going to very clearly see that music, really all music, that we experience, at least in the West, is very definitely influenced tremendously by Christianity and the church. So I said, okay, how do I do this? Because first thing you do is Google, right? Music, Christianity. You get some things, but not really. I've read 6 or 7 books on it, and unlike Jim McAllister, I can't remember the names of the authors. I've got the books, but I've read a few books on it. And really, you have to pull the information for the type of emphasis that we're wanting to do here. You have to pull it from the sources. They're not written with that emphasis of, this is how Christianity changed music. No, it's a theme that you can look at and see, but that's not the intent of the authors of the books. So, regrettably, or maybe enjoyably, it depends on who you are and how you're wired. We'll touch on a few aspects of music appreciation. For those of you who thought you were getting a cheap course in college, an easy course in college by taking Music Appreciation 101, maybe your time spent there, you'll remember a little bit of those things as we go through this. But this is not intended to be a music appreciation course. And I will tell you one thing that we won't be doing. This is not a course or a class on how to do church music or what's right or what's wrong with church music. There's plenty of books written about that. There's plenty of differences amongst well-meaning Christians on what church music, today's congregational or even broadcast church music or Christian music, should look like. That's not what we'll be discussing here. If there's interest in that, Later on, at some other point, maybe we talk about those things, but that's clearly not what we're doing. So basically, and if this magic stuff here works, and it works if I turn it on, sometimes. Let's see here. Okay, and now that's got this really cool thing here too. See? The class will look at the shaping influence that Christianity placed on the music that we have. Now, that's a pretty broad statement. But how did Christianity shape music as we see it? We will emphasize those aspects which would not have been had it not been for Christian influences. A fancy word for that is the sine qua non, that without which nothing. In other words, this would not have even existed had it not been for Christianity. And we will investigate and look at the role of the church and Christianity in the preservation and the development of many of the musical forms that we have. And you might want to ask, I know David. He's an electrical engineer. He likes to play with cars. He's gone half the time traveling wherever. So what in the world does he have in the way of credentials to talk about this subject right here? Let me first say, I guess in the best sense of the word, I'm an amateur at the subject. Word amateur simply being somebody who does something because they love it, which is actually where the word amateur comes from. So that's about as much as I can bring as far as credentials for it. For those of you who are here on Wednesday evenings, you heard some rather bizarre stuff. I actually have liked classical music from the time I was a small child. There's a story I won't relate, but I corrected a radio station when they played Tchaikovsky and it was actually Beethoven, or vice versa. I can't remember which. I was 4 years old. I took piano for 6 years. Okay, so that gives, at least I had to try to read music. Now, I got the proficiency of a second-year student in 6 years. So I obviously was very gifted in music. People say, okay, what can you play? And I say, let me tell you, I can play one mean stereo. In fact, as a kid, I installed 8-track players and stuff like that. I could play a mean stereo. And for those of you who don't know, because we will be getting into some of this a little bit, I do have some background in classical languages, Greek, Latin particularly, a smattering of Hebrew, part of a sojourn in college before I went and got the engineering degree. So I do have some exposures that way. And last but not least, you know I travel a lot, so I have indeed slept in the Holiday Inn Express. So that should certainly give me qualifications. Okay. I figured we had to talk about music itself. What is it? So here we go. Some stuff that try to keep you alive. Maybe I might have to get up and do jumping jacks at some point in the middle of this. But the word music actually comes from the Greek word musikē, by way of the Latin word musica, and it was ultimately derived from the word musa or a muse. Anybody from poetry classes or whatever, you talk about someone's muse that kind of visits them, that, you know, and they really thought of it that way in a visitation, but that, you know, you actually are lifted up. So it comes from the word muse, and in ancient Greece it was used to mean, and this is important, it was used to mean any of the arts or sciences governed by the muses. Later in Rome, musica embraced poetry as well as instrument-oriented music. And we'll touch on a guy named Pythagoras a little bit. In the European Middle Ages, music was part of what was called the mathematical quadrivium, or the four parts of mathematical investigation, which were arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. Why music? Hang on. Maybe this will whet your appetite a little bit. And the concept of music was split into three major kinds. This was at least identified by the 5th century philosopher Boethius, a Christian, 5th century AD, by the way. Musica universalis, musica humana, musica instrumentalis, music of the universe, music of the human, music of the instruments. And of those, only the last one refers to the performed music as we have it. And Boethius' definition hinged on a concept of harmony. Harmony of the heavenly bodies. If you remember, we've already talked about, geocentrism, earth-centered, heliocentrism, sun-centered orientation of the planets. That was a big deal in the Middle Ages, and it was because, in part, harmony, that everything be in harmony of some type, was very, very important. And that actually fell under the canopy of music. And then the harmony of the human body. Everybody has seen the sketch done by Leonardo da Vinci of the human here with a circle drawn around him, and how, from here to here to here to here, everything is in proportion. Again, the striving for recognizing and seeing harmony in the human body. And then lastly, the harmony in the proportion of musical sounds. And again, that does go back to Pythagoras. But there's another way that music can be looked at. And that other way that music can be looked at is as a category of perception. Anybody here involved in the social sciences or perceptive sciences? Maybe Karen, you've looked at some things like this a little bit, but this is not a definition that a lot of people think about a lot of times, because unfortunately, and I do say it unfortunately, when we say music in our common culture, we think of either the enjoyable or the barrage of sound that we get pushed on us all the time. I don't care whether you're put on hold on the phone. Somebody thinks they've got to give you some kind of music. If you're standing in line at the grocery store, you've got to have some kind of music. They select the tempo of music in restaurants depending on whether they want you to have a relaxed time or whether they want to get you out and flip the table. That is, quote, music. I think it's a horrible, I'll go ahead and hint, I think it's a horrible misuse of sound, and really a barrage which tends to make us dismiss something which really has a lot more capability and power, i.e. music, than we get, because it's always on the radio. My grandchildren got something last night. It was some little bird. I don't know what it was, but it was in a McDonald's box, and it had some sort of 3 or 4 note thing, da 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 da, or something like that. And by the time I'd heard it about 60 times, I began to just about come unglued. Just this monotony, if you will, of a particular sound over and over. But music is not merely the sound or the perception of sound, but music can be looked at as a means by which we perceive and action and memory are organized. This definition is influential to the cognitive sciences, which search to locate the regions of the brain responsible for parsing or remembering different aspects of musical experience. And this definition does include dance. Now, that was something I found as a quotation. And then I observed, by looking at the early Christians, I believe that the evidence points to this as a working definition of music as used and understood by the early Christians, even in an era before there was science to back it up. And we'll see why in just a second. Now, this question, this whole class that I'm being asked to do, is really something that, I don't know, could have hardly been done 200 years or so ago. I think we need to realize that even asking this question and the ability to place into one context many eras, genres, and ethnicities of music is a unique opportunity of our time. Few other times have had a working knowledge of music except that with which they were immediately familiar. If you take the people today in Africa who are not connected electronically to the world, maybe some of those in Togo, their knowledge of music is solely what they hear performed right around them. I think from our perspective right here, we need to grasp and understand that we have a big view of music. We can look back, and we will. We can look back 2 centuries before, 2 millennia before Christ. We can look to today. We can look to the Far East. We can look to Western civilization. We can go to YouTube and pull up nigh any musical style you want to and get a creditably good rendition of a certain musical style. I know, I've done a lot of it just preparing for this class. But that's something that, you know, even 20 years ago, we couldn't have done without that type of effort. You probably remember hearing people in the 30s and stuff like that who went into Appalachia and recorded with recording devices, you know, captured the sound of Appalachian music and stuff like that. That was really a beginning of what they call ethnomusicology, the study of ethnic music. And that occurred right here, you know, was born right here in the Christian West. But we stand at a unique point in time to even be able to look at this. Another quick example. Everybody in here familiar with the name J.S. Bach? Johann Sebastian Bach, the oldest of the Bachs. Within about 10 years of his death, none of his music was performed. And what people knew around him, and he traveled very little, his music was performed only in a fairly tight circle. And then 10 years after his death, it pretty much receded. It was not until a century or so later when people like Beethoven, who actually poured back through the music, said, no, wait a second, this guy was really great. I mean, there were some people that did schlock during that period of time. But this guy was really great, and he deserves to have an audience again. And they trained orchestras to again play his music. And it was rediscovered by people 100 years or so after he died. But, again, that's back to where we are right now. We're blessed with being able to look across times, which is just unique to who we are. And I note that even asking the question is born, in many respects, of the way our own Christianity has made us think about the world. It arises in the Christian West. I mean, the question itself, why look at music? What is its effect? What does it do? It arises in the Christian West. No other society, no other religious or ethnic group has shown any interest or emphasis on examining, collecting, comparing, and preserving music, not its own. So if you hang with me here, I'm going to give you the major points of the class, and the rest of the class will be a matter of kind of backing up these major assertions. Observations of Christian influence. Musical notation. Everybody grab a songbook or whatever. You can flip it open. It's got little squares and lines and triangles and you know all these little things. And with a little bit of education, you can know that translates into certain music. That's what I mean by musical notation. And scholarship arose in the early Middle Ages, and it proceeded through the High Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, directly under the influence and guidance of the church. That's really the phenomenal gift through the church to the concept of music itself. Just really blew me away that I realized that that's where it all came from. I am unqualified to really talk much about number two. The Western musical tone scale was developed by and for musicians for performing music in the churches. All the musicians are out there, though some of y'all are musical. Perhaps I could pick on Todd, but there was something called modal music, and then now we have what's called well-tempered music. Everybody knows a piano's got 12 keys. Your major things are do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, but those intervals that we select are unique to our Western culture, and we have eight of them. There are other scales which only have five notes, and I can't do it, but if you play the black keys of piano, you'll approximate that. Okay, but the Western musical tone scale came through the church. The church was the incubator and the driving force for the perceived importance of passing it on accurately. We'll get into that a little bit later. The preservation, restoration, and reenactment of music of previous times was fostered. And there's a sense of place and of appreciation. You find even in the Vatican, there was certain music that was held on for centuries and actually guarded. There's some interesting stories around some of that. It was actually guarded to the extent that you don't let it out. It's our music, and we don't want them performing in other places. That way everybody will come to Vatican City because they can hear this music, and we want to hold it. Not particularly the most attractive aspect of Christian application of music, but nonetheless, it was there, and they did keep it and record it that way. The development of numerous musical instruments grew directly under the encouragement of the church. The organ, for sure, as we know it. Symphonic stringed and wind instruments. Important to realize that many musicians were employed by the church, were at monasteries or at churches and wrote music for the churches. Therefore, the instruments, they developed the instruments in order to enhance church music. Many of the classical forms of music, and yeah, I'm going to have to touch on classical because really classical really owes its very existence to the church. So for those of you, if you happen, and I hope you don't have a strong distaste for classical music, but if you happen to have a distaste for it, you can then blame the church, if you will, for the very existence of classical music. That I would find that very sad, but nonetheless, you could possibly do that. So many of the classical forms and numerous of its greatest composers were initially and many continuously employed in giving their talents and service to the church. Now, fast forward into our friends from Togo and other places like that. Slaves ripped from their homelands preserved portions of their musical heritage while changing the lyrics and the themes to Christian lyrics and themes. So we find that their music, their musical sound, their musical forms, they were not allowed to practice it as they were, as they had over in Africa, but they learned to be able to keep the form going with the words changed. And quite frankly, I want to think very positively about it, that actually, even though white men gave them or taught them Christianity, that they embraced Christianity itself, and through their own background, their own heritage, they wrote, not necessarily writing wrote, but they made up songs in glory to God using the talents that they have, which was their musical heritage. And even the invention of musical recording itself. Everybody knows that Edison invented the phonograph. Okay, everybody got that in elementary school somewhere. Guess where that came from, right? That's right, right here out of the Christian West. And so really, if you want to take a break, and check out for the next week or so, however long it takes me to go through this. You've got right now the basic points that are there. Now if you're interested I hate it when people say this, 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 and this, and don't give me any reason. Don't give me any background. They just make the assertions and walk off. I think that's pretty disingenuous. But nonetheless, if you want to walk now, you've got the points. Thank you very much. If you would like to hear a little bit more about it, or even if you're just being nice to me, you can sit and we'll continue. Back to the idea of music as a category of perception, because this is a very important part of the way the church, and I'm talking about the church here very early on. In fact, we'll back it up, even the Jewish and Greek influences. The church used music as a mnemonic device, i.e. it helps us remember, a memory trick. And they used meter in poetry. Everybody knows the psalm, "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases." How much easier is it to know, though, "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him." I guarantee you, it's easier to recite that with the tune than it is to try to simply memorize the words. So that's true, and it teaches truth. It's musical. It advances many things. It glorifies God. Chant. Okay, yeah, you're going to hear some chant in a little while. What in the ding dong is chant? How did everybody learn their ABCs? A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know. So, see, chant works as something. We have a bit of a rhythm. We have something that's very simple to follow. And we have information transmitted to us and ingrained in us much better. Music was also used. In fact, the word hymn itself means praise to a deity or an offering of praise. That's what the word hymn means. And, of course, it's used in opening of celebration of praise. What are these all set up here? What are we going to do here in just a few minutes? We're going to open up in celebration of praise to a deity. So that's one of mankind's used music that way for a long time. The church, that's stuff that pre-existed that the church appropriated. Music is used for events of state. What do you do before any ball game? You praise the heroic deeds of people of the past. And in our culture, in the USA, we sing the Star Spangled Banner. And gratefully, we've got some people that are introducing God Bless America into some of those times. But again, a time of declaring deity and remembering brave deeds of the past. Music is definitely, now again, I want to try to be fair. It's not like music is all, you know, intellectual and ethereal and stuff like that. No, it's not true. Music has always been used by common people. You put any group of people together, somebody's going to pick up something and tap something, get something going, and it's going to be used for popular dance. It's going to be used on Saturday nights, square dances, stuff like that, as you drop back a little bit in our own culture. But it's always been used that way. Music also can be used for masking pain or masking reason. Now, this gets to be a little bit of a darker emphasis of music, and I do not ascribe or think that the church used it that way, but nonetheless, we need to look at it. And very often, interestingly, the early church did not use much of a drum beat for exactly this reason, that the pulsing of a drum beat was often used to induce ecstatic experiences on the part of people to kind of take them away. Ecstasis just means to step outside yourself. to take them out of where they were and sort of transport them. And many times you set reason, you set a lot of things aside, and you'll act in ways that you shouldn't. The particular example I show up there of a guy named Attis, let's just say he really got caught up in the act, and he ended up not being a complete man. And that's recorded in some Latin poetry. I'll let you draw the conclusions from that. We got time to get Jewish influences out of the way, and then we'll probably pick up with Greek ones. There are two pillars, if you will, on which Christian music stands. Jewish influence, Greek influence. And after all the folks that we know, Paul, all the writers of the New Testament, and shortly thereafter, they were immersed in both of those cultures. Jewish culture was the root out of which Christianity grew. Greek culture was that in which they lived. Now, yes, they lived under the Romans, but interestingly, when Rome conquered Greece, Greek culture conquered Rome. The culture of Greece permeated Rome as Rome militarily conquered Greece. So it is very, very fair to say Greek culture, even though the church grew up in times of Roman dominance. But the early church was indeed familiar with Scripture. We know that from Paul. And just a few scriptures here. It's good to give thanks to the Lord and to sing praise to your name, O Most High, to declare your loving kindness in the morning and your faithfulness by night, with the 10-string lute and with the harp, with resounding music upon the lyre. For you, O Lord, have made me glad by what you have done, and I will sing for joy at the works of your hand. No question about music. Give thanks to the Lord. Call on his name. Make known his deeds among the people. Make them remember that his name is exalted. Praise the Lord in song, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. And they sang a new song, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." I selected that one particularly, A, because I love what George Frederick Handel did with that particular phrase, and just as a real quick opportunity, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, anybody who cares to join me, the parts 2 and 3 of Handel's Messiah will be performed at Covenant Presbyterian Church, and I elect to go there. Parts 2 and 3, for those of you who may not be familiar, part 1 of the Messiah is of Handel's Messiah is about his birth, about God's gift to man. Part 2 is about what we did with that gift. Part 3 is about what the victory God wrought over that. So, indeed, it's rather appropriate that this particular week we deal with part 2, what man did with the gift, and then what God did to reconcile or to actually win victory over that. That's this. But that phrase, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain," that may very well have been an early Christian hymn. We have no proof of it, but there are phrases like that one that may well have been an early Christian hymn. And of course, we've got the Psalms. They built upon the Psalms. They knew from their Jewish influence the Psalms, and they sang the Psalms. After all, Jesus with his disciples, what'd they do? They sang a hymn, which was a psalm, probably one of them in the 130s, and then walked out on the night of his betrayal. So that's part of the practice that Jesus himself actually passed on. They were familiar with synagogue worship. Interestingly, a fairly interesting point that I think I found, and y'all may snooze through it nonetheless, in the temple there were instruments, because the temple was the place where people worshiped God. It was a place of pilgrimage, and it employed trained singers and trained musicians. We find in the Old Testament scripture to select and train and hold up certain ones to be the skilled singers. They sang at the temple. But people didn't go. I mean, Israel was a community. It was not somebody who all lived and daily went to the temple. No, they went to the temple three or four times a year. That's all they did. So that's where they got to really, in that sense, in the full-blown sense, worship God. The rest of the time, they worshiped kind of house church-wise or the synagogues. By the time we get to synagogue singing or chant, and by the way, a lot of it was chant, it was likely, fancy word there, is voice only, a cappella, sotto voce. Instrumental music was not revived and used in the synagogue after the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 A.D. They did keep the symbolic shofar, which was a horn that I think is still used today in Orthodox communities. But as far as musical embellishment, there's not that much of it. But the chant continued, and research has made it increasingly clear that many of the forms and even melodic patterns of the Byzantine and Western Christian chants were adaptations from the music of the synagogues. Okay, not a lot of other people come. Maybe we can get through Greek influence pretty fast. The Greeks had a long oral tradition, and especially Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. That was an oral epic. It was not written until many centuries after Homer, but it was preserved and preserved with remarkable accuracy over hundreds of years by being learned and recited metrically, chanted, sung, whatever you want to call it. They had love poetry, the music from Delphi, and there are actually some examples of it. They had numerous stringed instruments and flute-like, oboe-like instruments. And music was also a strong element of education. Okay, this is, Todd, where I actually had an example. So I got to walk over here, I think, and click it, because I don't think I'd make the sound. I was doing pretty good with this little clicker right here, but not well enough to make this happen. So here you go. An audible.
Πάντερ και όσα γλαόμορφο ή και σύνος ανάκτος επίθρονον ιερονίζει.
Now we don't know whether it really sounded like that or not, because we're not exactly sure what their musical notation, what to do with that musical notation. Let's just say that's a modern, educated guess, but that is part of Homer's Iliad. Music, we sing for the beauty of the earth, and one of the phrases in that is the music of the spheres. Well, guess what? That came from Pythagoras, back to what I was talking about a little bit earlier, with music having two or three parts to it. The part of it was music universalis, the music of the spheres, the harmony of the spheres, not actually the fact that they make sounds. No, that's a misapplication or a misunderstanding of what music was to them. But Pythagoras and his school, and they laid foundations and knowledge for the study of harmonics. He studied stringed instruments. We'll see people, they'll fret the stringed instrument, they'll mash it at certain places, which changes the frequency at which the string vibrates. And thereby you've got tones. You've got major and minor tones that are accomplished by that. Same thing with a wind column and a flute. All of those things. The church inherited that. But it's important to note that the entire study of such things by the Greeks was less a formula for the production of playable music than it was a mathematical and philosophical description of how the universe in general was perceived to be constructed. The stars, the sun, the planets, all vibrating or moving about in harmony. Music was produced modally. I'm not going to get into that very strong for those who know, other than to say that there were four modes of music, and those modes were later adapted by the church. This is kind of interesting. This is going to sound like an old guy coming down on people. And in many respects, this was an old guy coming down on people. So maybe think of some of your church heritage as I read this particular quotation to you and see what this sounds like. Our music was once divided into its proper forms. It was not permitted to exchange the melodic style of these established forms and others. Knowledge and informed judgment penalized disobedience. There were no whistles, unmusical mob noises, or clapping for applause. The rule was to listen silently, to learn. Boys, teachers, and the crowd were kept in order by threat of the stick. But later, an unmusical anarchy was led by poets who had natural talent but were ignorant of the laws of music. Through foolishness, they deceived themselves into thinking that there was no right or wrong way in music, that it was to be judged good or bad by the pleasure that it gave. By their works and their theories, they infected the masses with the presumption to think themselves adequate judges. So our theaters, once silent, grew vocal. The aristocracy of music gave way to a pernicious theatocracy. The criterion was not music, but a reputation for promiscuous cleverness and a spirit of lawbreaking. Plato. Music may serve to form judgments of the child by connecting moral concepts and pleasures. It's thus for teaching to form tastes. Yeah, that may be a good place to stop just because I can't make it advance. Oh! Okay, the influences on the early church form. We'll pick up on that because that'll be a good place to kind of summarize and get back in when next we get together. Thanks for your patience.